Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky. The New York Times best-selling author of The Kennedy Women chronicles the powerful and spellbinding true story of a brutal race-based killing in 1981 and subsequent trials that undid one of the most pernicious organizations in American history, the Ku Klux Klan. On a Friday night in March 1981, Henry Hayes and James Knowles scoured the streets of Mobile, Alabama in their car, hunting for a black man. The young men were members of Claver 900 of the United Klans of America. They were seeking to retaliate after a largely black jury could not reach a verdict in a trial involving a black man accused of the murder of a white man. The two Klansmen found 19-year-old Michael Donald walking home alone. Hayes and Knowles abducted him, beat him, cut his throat, and left his body hanging from a tree branch in a racially mixed residential neighborhood. Arrested, charged, and convicted, Hayes was sentenced to death, the first time in more than half a century that the state of Alabama sentenced a white man to death for killing a black man. On behalf of Michael's grieving mother, Morris Dees, the legendary civil rights lawyer and co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center, filed a civil suit against the members of the local Klan unit involved and the UKA, the largest Klan organization. Charging them with conspiracy, Dees put the Klan on trial, resulting in a verdict that would level a deadly blow to its organization. The lynching brings to life two dramatic trials during which the Alabama Klan's motives and philosophy were exposed for the evil they represented. In addition to telling a gripping and consequential story, Lawrence Leamer chronicles the KKK and its activities in the second half of the 20th century, and illuminates its lingering effect on race relations in America today. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Lynching, the epic courtroom battle that brought down the Klan, with my special guest, journalist and author, Lawrence Leamer. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Lawrence Leamer.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for coming on, and we're going to get to talk about an incredibly important book about an incredibly important time, if not the most important time in American history. Unlike your book, let's go back to February 1956. Morris Dees is in his second year at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa, and he's married with a newborn and trying to get his college and law degree in 4 years. Tell us about Morris Dees, a little bit about his background, and what is he doing in 1956? I mentioned he's in school. Tell us more about Morris Dees, a little bit about his character, and what is he doing in 1956?
Well, Morris Dees is this tall, sort of incredibly handsome young man. His father is a tenant farmer in the cotton country outside of Montgomery, Alabama. He grows up a segregationist, as did every other white person in Alabama, although he had a lot of black friends, and most of his friends were black. And I know that because several of them are his friends for life, and I interviewed a couple of them for my book. But he was a segregationist. He had black friends, but those friends wouldn't come in the house and sit down with their family for dinner, that's for sure. So Morris, you know, he realizes that racial things are not right. He has there's one of the workers, one of the field hands that his father has on his land, and he's stopped by a state police trooper who says that he's drunk, and he's not drunk at all. Something's happened to his car, and they fine him this enormous amount. And Morris is just a teenager. What does he know about the law? But he decides to go to help this black fellow go into court and try to get this fine, get off this thing because he didn't really do anything wrong. And they go into the courthouse. It's just in a country store there, and he tells his case, and the state trooper says, no, he's drunk. There's no evidence against him, but they fine him $300. And this man, made about $1 a day, and $300 was, just a devastating amount for him. And at that point, Morris just saw that the life was unfair, and black people weren't treated right in Alabama. He understood that. He was a segregationist, but he knew things weren't right.
So he enrolls in college trying to get his law degree, and at that time at the University of Alabama, there is a protest. Again, we're talking about segregation, and everyone's a segregationist, and it was the issue at that time. And it was a black woman named Authorine Lucy was trying to become the first black student to attend the school. So this sets up all of the – you introduce a lot of characters because they come into play right at this time. So – tell us about this protest and this Authorine Lucy.
Well, this is crucial in the history of the Klan and the history of the fight against integration, because the Klan came out and, along with college students, got out and started rioting against this young woman who only wanted an education. She really wasn't a civil rights activist. She wanted a kind of library education, and the University of Alabama was the only place you could get what she wanted. And she just got pushed into this activist role that she didn't even want. And Morris had gotten married when he was a senior in high school. His bride got pregnant. He had a brand new baby. He didn't have any money. He had to struggle to get through college. He did everything he could to make money. He went to the dorms. He and his wife made sandwiches, and they took him around to the dormitories at night. And when he went that night, all they were talking about was this black woman trying to get into school, and what could they do? Well, the protests were so extreme that they pushed her out, and she did not enter the school. That Morris was a very good Baptist. Some people think, because his name is Morris Seligman Dees, a lot of people think he's Jewish. He's not Jewish. His grandfather named his three sons after three Jewish businessmen he admired, but he was a Baptist, and he was the leader of the marriage students in the Baptist church there on campus. And that Sunday he got up in church and said, this is not right what was done to Miss Lucy. I mean, that's not how we should behave. Well, there was kind of murmuring in the church that day, and the minister came to him the next week and said, Morris, we don't think you're really that prepared to be the head of the students, have the role you have in the church, and you better back off of that. So the Morris learned right then what would happen if he stood up.
Now, you talk about his father was a tenant farmer, but his father did have a great interest in politics and was a gregarious guy and had some connections. So you talk about in the book the first time that Dees is inspired politically or interested in politics was with a friend of his father, Big Jim Folsom. So tell us about that event and how it inspired Morris Dees.
Well, with Big Jim Folsom was the kind of character you don't see anymore. He was a bigger than life in every way. He was 6'6", wildly overweight, heavy drinker, very much of a populist. He thought that the white establishment had done everything to keep the poor whites and the poor blacks from understanding that they had more together, they had more to gain to working together than they did working apart. And the establishment knew that if they flamed racism and kept the white working class from having anything to do with blacks, that was the one way they could keep power. And that's what Jim Big Folsom said they were doing. But one day he said that the white working class and the black working class would get together and there would be a different society. And that's what he was trying to do as governor. He was a very, very popular governor. And he'd come out to the D's home for and just sit there and get drunk. He'd just sit there and drink until he could finally hardly walk. And his black aide and chauffeur, you know, picked him up and put him back in the car and drove him back to the mansion in Montgomery. But that's the first time that Morris got interested in politics and the idealistic part of politics.
And that interest in politics was not just a passing thing. He was seen as very ambitious. So what was his political life and his future as a result of this ambition?
Well, he was terribly ambitious. He wanted to make a lot of money. He had all these businesses going with his friend Millard Fuller, who eventually started Habitat for Humanity. They were in college together. They had all kinds of businesses. They did the student guidebook. They did cakes. They figured out that you could send letters to the parents and tell them that your son's having his birthday next month, and for $5 we'll deliver a cake to his dormitory. He made a lot of money. Made all kinds of money. But he's politically ambitious too. And in 1958, he took a semester off from school and was George Wallace's student campaign manager in the state in Wallace's first run for governor. Now, George Wallace was another poor boy. George Wallace was a University of Alabama student and got his law degree from the University of Alabama, as did Morris Deese. And George Wallace knew. A smart guy. He had the most brilliant sense of politics of anyone of his generation, other than probably Lyndon Johnson. He understood the white working class. And he knew that segregation was going to end after the 1954 Supreme Court decision. It was just a matter of time before it was going to end. But he realized that if he became a militant segregationist, that was the quickest way to power. He could manipulate these people and motivate them and tell them there'd never be integration, and he could rise to the governorship and maybe to the Senate, and who knows where he could go like this. But he was very cynical. He could have been the clerk of Alabama, doing what the president de Klerk of South Africa did in working with Nelson Mandela to end the abhorrent system of apartheid. George Wallace maybe could have done that. It would have been very difficult, but he chose a very different route. And in 1958, Morris was there behind him as a student campaign manager.
And Morris not only learned the ins and outs of politics in terms of campaigning and what it took to really get out there and get votes and organize people and get them to the vote that day, but also he was privy to exactly what George Wallace thought at the same time the strategy that he employed. So he was aware of the reality behind George Wallace, wasn't he?
Well, Morris these days like to say, well, you know, Wallace wasn't that bad. John Patterson's opponent was a lot worse. Well, if you look at the clippings, Wallace during that campaign criticizing Patterson for not being tough enough on segregation. So that doesn't hold water. To run for office in those days, you pretty much had to be a segregationist. And Morris Deese was supporting a segregationist. There's no question about it. And 3 years later, as a young lawyer in 1961, there were the Freedom Rides. Remember the Freedom Rides and the racially mixed groups came down the South on the interstate buses, and when they reached Birmingham, they were beaten up, bludgeoned half to death by members of the United Klans of America. And then another bus rides in Montgomery, Alabama, the capital of Alabama, and they get out and they're bludgeoned there. Some people with these injuries they never recovered from. Leading them was a man that Morris ends up his lawyer. As a young lawyer, he defends this man. He defends him. Now, Morris says, well, I didn't know he was a member of the Klan. Well, I don't know how he didn't know, but he says he didn't know. He defended him in the courtroom, and there were other defendants. One of the other defendants was Robert Shelton. Robert Shelton was the imperial wizard of United Klans of America, the most powerful Klan leader in the United States. And he, too, had gone to the University of Alabama. He dropped out, but he was a pre-law student. He was a smart young man and became such a rabid segregationist that he decided he would make his career through the Klan. And when he sat in that courtroom and he sees Morris Deese defending one of his fellow Klan leaders, he thinks legitimately enough that Morris is pro-Klan, and most of the lawyers that defended Klansmen were either Klansmen or they were pro-Klan. Now Morris wasn't, and Morris says, "Well, I just defended him because I think a lawyer defends everybody." But in those days, you really couldn't do that. When you defended a Klansman, people thought certain things about you. In any case, when that case ended in the courtroom, one of the freedom runners came up to Morris Dees and said, "How could you do this, Morris? How could you do this? How could you be on this side?" And he realized how wrong he was. He realized he had to go a different route. And 3 years later, when four little black girls were killed in Birmingham in the bombing done by the United Klans of America and done under the instigation of Robert Shelton, Morris Dees saw that, and he saw how terrible that was. He went to his Baptist church in Montgomery outside in the countryside that Sunday, and he was a lay preacher. In those days, you didn't need credentials to be a preacher. You could just get up and preach. He did it many Sundays. And he got up that Sunday, and he said, "You know, my fellow Baptists, you know, we've got these fellow Baptists in Birmingham. We've got these fellow Baptists that are in trouble. We've got to help them." And the people shouted out, "Yes, brother. Brother Morris, tell us. We want to help our fellow Baptists." He said, "Well, there were these four little black girls were killed in the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham. We got to help them." And they shouted, "No, Morris, no, Morris, be quiet. We don't want to hear about this. We want to hear about this. This isn't our business. Stay to your own business." And Morris kept on talking and talking, and they wouldn't listen. And finally he said, "Well, let's pray. Let's shut our eyes and pray." So Morris bowed his head and shut his eyes and prayed for quite a while. He raised his head, opened his eyes, and looked out in the church, and everybody was gone. Everybody was gone. He was ostracized.
He was ostracized by his own family as well.
Well, he was ostracized. The next year, the time of the Selma March, famous Selma March, at the beginning of that march with Martin Luther King, Morris and his fellow friend, his partner, Millard Fuller, drove a bunch of people, civil rights activists who had come flown down, you know, ministers, basically, mainly Lutheran ministers, drove them to Selma to take part in the march. That's all he did. He didn't take part in the march himself. But at that time, a state trooper came to his mother's house and said, "Your son, Morris, he's getting himself in a lot of trouble. He's with those communists. You better stop being with those communists. There's no telling what's going to happen to him." So that was the thing. Everybody's being watched in those days. You went just a little bit off the straight and narrow in terms of segregation. You were in trouble. And Morris had walked a little bit off that road.
Now, in 1956, when Morris Dees was at the University of Alabama and he was witness to this black woman authoring Lucy not being able to get into college, and then, you know, a couple thousand people, as you write in your book, cheering and jeering at her, and they used some excuse to make sure that she was excluded from that university.
Right.
Among the protesters, you say that day was the important character Robert Shelton, and also Asa Carter and Robert Chambliss, and he had saw the film Birth of a Nation, you said, and he was an explosives expert, and there was a couple bombings like in Martin Luther over the bus boycott, and that they thought
right.
might be related to him. So let's talk about Robert Shelton, Asa Carter, Robert Chambliss, and what they were doing in 1956 before we talk about what they're doing in 1961.
Okay. They are these socially disconnected people, okay? They're not churchgoers. They're not union members. They don't belong to the Rotary Club. They don't have too many friends. And in the Klan, they find an identification and purpose. They're lower class, they're working class whites. And the whites, most whites look down on them, think they're white trash. The only people they can look down on are black people. And they don't want black people to rise up. And at the time of Lucy trying to enter the University of Alabama, Robert Shelton was a young Klansman. And he was there and he was taking part in this riot. And he just loved it. And Asa Carter was there. He was a very smart young man, a very talented young man, and a Klansman. He was there, And Robert Chambliss was there. And Robert Chambliss would become notorious later as a bomb maker. We talk about the bomb makers now in terms of the terrorists and ISIS and how important role they play. Well, Robert Shelton was the bomb maker for the United Clans of America. He made the bombs that blew up the Birmingham church at the direction of Robert Shelton. And Robert Shelton was there, and Asa Carter was a member of a Klan in Birmingham that castrated a black man. I mean, these were terrible people, the things that they did, but they weren't stupid people. They weren't stupid at all.
Now, it's important because you tie in Shelton, and we talked about Governor Patterson versus Judge Wallace trying to be governor, and them both using segregation, the issue segregation, to their benefit, but also accusing each other of belonging or having ties with the KKK, which actually worked out for Patterson, you know, amazingly in your book chronicle. The thing is that Shelton had meteoric rise, as you say, to Grand Dragon, but there's a really close relationship with Wallace and Patterson. Tell us about that relationship and how much power does Robert Shelton have as a Grand Dragon?
Well, in 1958, Robert Shelton directs the United Clans of America to work for Patterson, who in the runoff election, Patterson and Wallace were the number one and two candidates. The runoff is between them. Right before the election, Wallace criticizes the Klan. He says that Patterson has the Klan support, and it's terrible. And if he wins, the Klan will be in power. Patterson won, and so Wallace changes his tune, and he thinks, "I want that Klan support." And so he goes to Robert Shelton, and 4 years later, he has that support, and it's very important. Because these Klans people, not only the thousands of them, but they'll do things that ordinary supporters won't do. They'll go out at night, and they'll rip down the advertising and the signposts and the billboards for your opponent. They'll just rip it down. They don't care, and they'll threaten people and scare people. They'll scare people into voting for you. You know, they're very important, and so they helped Wallace win election in 1962 on a very racist segregationist tick. The famous story in 58 when Wallace loses on that night, and he's just devastated, and he goes to the hotel where he's got to talk to his supporters and who are there to thank them, and he's just in such a terrible mood, and he uses the N-word and says, I will not be out and end again. I'm not going to be out and not end again. And he wasn't, and he took that racist segregationist theme and built it as strong as he could. He got Robert Shelton, the United Clans, to get behind him. They helped him get elected in 62. He paid Shelton back. Shelton was a tire worker in the Goodrich plant in Tuscaloosa, right on the line, a real worker. And Wallace got that company the contract for the state tires, and so Shelton got out of the plant. Got out of doing that, and he got a more executive job, and he could drive around the state doing contracts and talking to his Klansmen. And Wallace got Shelton's father a job as well. And then the Klan was willing to do just what George Wallace wanted. But nobody knew this. And that was the story of the South in those days. People pretended the Klan was this outcast, ne'er-do-well organization. But the Klan did, for the most part, what the establishment wanted it to do.
Now let's get back to where Morris Dees is in terms of the formation of the Southern Poverty Law Center. When does that happen, and what is the impetus for that? Why does he do that? You talked about him being an entrepreneur, so that's where he gets his money. He finances this thing himself. So tell us about the reasons for this and the formation of the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Well, he makes a fortune. A very smart guy. He and his partner Miller Fuller, they do book publishing, and they're for a time the largest publisher of cookbooks in America. Very smart guys. They make a fortune. They sell the business. I forget. I think it was $8 or $9 million. You know, in the '60s, a lot of money, and he can do what he wants for the rest of his life. And he realizes that there's a role. The civil rights movement, which which we the modern day civil rights movement, which we tend to think starts at the time of the Montgomery bus boycott in 55-66 and ends with the death of Martin Luther King. But there's a lot of work to be done, and it wasn't to be done primarily by marches. Okay, it was to be done with the law, and the law. So often the role of the law in the civil rights movement has been downplayed because it's much more dramatic and romantic to talk about the marches and the parades and all this and brave people standing up, and that they did. But the courts are very important, and particularly the federal courts. Without the federal courts, we would still have segregation in the South and a very different America. And so Morris then starts to start this civil rights law firm. In 1971, he calls it the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's really not about poverty, but that's what it's called. That's what the civil rights law firms were called at that time. He brings down five young, very smart young lawyers, and they start filing all these lawsuits. There's just a wealth of things they can file against. In Selma, Alabama, for example, on the white part of town, the roads are all paved. On the black part of town, they're all gravel or dirt. And so he sues to say that they got to pave the black part of town. They sue to get to integrate the state troopers. There was not a single black state trooper at that time. All kinds of lawsuits. Do a lot of good work. And Morris is a brilliant fundraiser. And he sends out these letters and gets all kinds of money. Can't believe all the money that starts pouring in, mainly from northern liberals, to fund this organization.
At the same time, he's not only criticized, he's not only ostracized. It's more serious than that, isn't it?
No, I mean, the Southern Poverty Law Center, the offices are firebombed by Klansmen, by members of the United Klans of America. One Christmas, he is there with his daughter putting the ornaments on the Christmas tree, and there are two intruders out on his ranch in camouflage uniforms and carrying assault weapons, and they're scared off by his own security people. But it was a serious business, and it was scary. And he's a very gutsy guy. He's something else. He's like no. He's not. I mean, people think of Atticus Fitch. Okay, every lawyer would like to be Atticus Fitch, the famous hero of Harper Lee's *To Kill a Mockingbird*. I think that image has ruined more lawyers than anything else because there never was an Atticus Fitch. There never was such a person. But Morris sees is more like Oscar Schindler, the hero of Spielberg's wonderful movie, who was a womanizing, a grandiose, self-centered Nazi businessman who ends up saving thousands of Jews. And Morris is not a morally perfect man, but he does the right thing in the right way. He's the kind of guy that in those years, he would drive his motorcycle 100 miles an hour down the country lanes. And on the weekends, he'd go off and ride in rodeos. So he in a way, liked danger. And he took chances very few people would have taken. And the other lawyers at the Southern Poverty Law Center really didn't like this.
And what did he say to them when they said, listen, you're endangering this business? Is this just your own concern? They saw it as his own campaign, his own mission, and not theirs. And what was his response to them?
Well, at the time of these murders, this lynching that's the center of my book, the two murderers eventually were found and sentenced. But Morris felt that wasn't enough, that he had to go after the head of the United Klans of America, Robert Shelton. And so he went to Beulah Donald, the mother of the murdered teenager, and he got her to file a civil suit. And that's what he did. And the other lawyers at the Southern Poverty Law Center didn't like this. They didn't like to be in danger. They didn't like. They thought this suit was stupid. They thought the judge would. There was no way. There never was a case of an organization being found guilty for what a couple of its members did. And so they thought it wouldn't work out. It was a waste of resources. And they eventually, all five of them, ended up quitting, walking away, rather than going ahead with this.
Now let's talk about, we'll get back to Robert Shelton and Claiborne 900 and that fateful meeting that they have at Robert Shelton, where Benny Hayes, Henry Hayes, Tiger Knowles, tell us about the meeting. You, in great description, you talk about the altar and the candle. So describe that scene of this Claiborne meeting in a cabin on Benny Hayes' property.
Okay. These guys are just nothing in society, okay? They're nothing anybody ever paying any attention to. And in the Klan, they find identity. And in these quasi-religious rituals, with the altar, with the cross, with the mumbo-jungle language, okay? They just love this stuff. They eat it up. They love to come to this meeting and take part in this. So there's one of these meetings in March of 1981, and there had been a black bank robber in Birmingham. He'd robbed a bank, and when he came out and was trying to escape, he had allegedly killed a white police officer. Now, the authorities in Birmingham knew that he couldn't find a fair trial there, so they brought him down to Mobile, and the trial was heard before a largely black jury. That evening at the Claiborne meeting, they decided that if this guy got off, and it was a hung jury, some of the Klan members would go out and find a black person and in retribution kill that black person. And so that Friday evening, sure enough, the jury came back with a hung jury. And so James Tiger Knowles and Henry Hayes went out looking for a black man. They found this old black gentleman talking to a telephone booth that he was too far away. And then 19-year-old Michael Don is walking there. He lives in the projects with his mother. He's the youngest of seven children. He's there, he's home that evening watching a basketball game. His family is sitting there playing cards. And his aunt says, about 11 o'clock, his aunt says, "Michael, will you go out and get me a pack of cigarettes?" And she gives him a dollar. That's all he had in his billfold. And he goes out to get the cigarettes. And he's walking on that street, and on that dark street, and this bureau comes up, and Tiger Knowles, 17 years old, Tiger Knowles pulls out a gun and orders Michael Donnelly into the car. Now, Michael Donnelly's not stupid, and Michael Donnelly is black, and he knows, he's a black Southerner. He knows when what's up. He knows what these people are likely to do. And obviously, he's terrified. They take him way out in the countryside, and they stop, and they order him out of the car. And you know what? This guy is the mildest person imaginable, but he fights back. He fights against them, and they knock him down. They beat him, and he gets up again. He gets up three times. And finally they get him down. He's breathing hard, and they go and get a lynching rope out of the trunk, bring it in, and Henry Hayes puts his boot on Michael Donald's forehead, and pulls the rope tight and strangles him to death. And then they're not sure. They want to make sure he's dead, so they go and get a knife and slit his throat. Now you think, why don't they just leave? Why don't they just bury the body or leave him in the woods or throw him in the ocean and get on with it? Well, because that's not enough. They got to make a symbol of this. So they throw the body back into the trunk, drive it back into Mobile, and hang it on Herndon Avenue, hang it in the tree there, because they want everybody to see their handiwork.
Now, where did the two go directly afterwards? And what do, as we see later, witnesses say was their appearance?
Well, they just go back to their friends. This street, there were Klansmen. The street, there were four houses on that street that had been owned by Benny Hayes, Henry Hayes' father, who was the most powerful Klan official in the southern part of the state. So it was known as a Klan habitat. And there were several apartments where the Klansmen went. And Tiger Knowles had blood in his shirt, and when he went in, one of the Klansmen saw the blood in his shirt and quickly got him to go outside and told him about the blood, and he changed his shirt. And other Klansmen got in cars and went to the courthouse and set a flaming cross there as a symbol of the Klan's power.
Now, it took a little while for the people of the city, or pardon me, the town, to realize what had happened. It wasn't an actual lynching because he was strapped to the tree, but tell us what happens with this crowd, this crowd that has gathered, and what's their reaction, and who comprises the crowd mostly?
Well, okay. There were a couple of black people who lived in that street, but that was about it. But it was in a poor neighborhood. And in the South at that time, the poorer the neighborhood, the more likely it was going to be racial mix. And this was a poor neighborhood. And so these black people started showing up, and they cry. And they're mainly out of that sort of religious tradition of the South. They're not embarrassed to show their emotions. And they cry, and they get down on their hands and knees, and they beat their fists against the ground because they know what has happened, okay? They know. Why do they know? Because there was a tradition of lynching in the South. From 1870 to 1955, there was a lynching of an average of over once a week. And they were psychologically a brilliant device to intimidate a race. Imagine if you're a black mother. How do you raise your son? Do you raise him to stand tall and bold, or do you raise him when you see a white man come on the sidewalk? You get off the sidewalk and duff your hat. If you want him to stay alive, you probably do the latter. So the fear of lynching, it hadn't been a lynching for 25 years, but the fear of lynching was in the black soul of the South, and they knew what it had done. Now, conversely, the white establishment did not want to admit that a lynching had happened. Mobile had a much better reputation than Montgomery or Birmingham in terms of racial matters. There was no national publicity but negative about it. They didn't want that to happen. They didn't want it to be said that there was a lynching. And so four of the five detectives, according to Bob Eddy, who was a state investigator who came down, four of the five detectives were racists. Okay, and they weren't looking around to find white people to help black people. And three white kind of, you know, probably young drug dealers or just ne'er-do-wells, they arrested them for the crime and said it was a drug crime, that Michael Donald, it had been a drug deal gone bad, that Michael Donald was buying drugs he hadn't paid, and these three guys had killed him. There was nothing in Michael Donald's reputation, no evidence that he was a drug dealer, none of this at all, okay? But that's what they said, and they arrested these three young men. And they would have put them in prison. They wouldn't even executed them for crime they didn't commit. But it had to go before a grand jury. Now, grand juries generally do pretty much what the prosecutor wants them to do. I mean, that's what they do. They're just lay people. They don't know that much about the law, and they believe in the authorities. But that time, when this came before them, they knew that this was wrong, and so they refused to give an indictment. These three young men went free. But the authorities in Mobile, they weren't going to go against this crime. And that's why people talk about states' rights, and they say, oh, we have to have states' rights. Yeah, in some ways, of course, we have to have states' rights. But states' rights is often just a subterfuge. It's just another word for racism. I'm sorry. And in this instance, what did it take? It took that morning of the lynching, there was a man, Michael Figures, who was a state senator. The black state senator, the most powerful black politician in the southern part of the state, he came that morning and he took pictures of the lynching, and he turned around and he took pictures across the street. And you know what it was, but he took a picture of three white men. One was Benny Hayes, the Klan leader, the big Klan leader, his son Henry Hayes, and Tiger Knowles, the two murderers, and the person that set them out to do this murder. And Michael Figure's brother, Thomas Figure, was an assistant U.S. attorney in Mobile, and he wanted to quit, but he said, if I quit, they aren't going to find, there's going to be no justice. So he constantly lobbied the Justice Department. He just lobbied the FBI. He lobbied the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department until finally they decided to come down, and they were the ones, through their efforts, through their grand jury, and bringing people before the grand jury, not only once, but two times, three times, four times, finally broke Tiger Knowles. He confessed, and he was sentenced eventually to 25 years in prison, and Henry Hayes was convicted and eventually executed. That never would have happened without the federal government.
Now, the federal government used every available leverage they could, including really digging up a robbery motive so this would be a capital case, which, again, because of that leverage, starts making people talk with that kind of pressure, doesn't it?
Well, no, the robbery, that's the state case. That's the case against Henry Hayes. When he goes to trial finally, at that time in Alabama, you could kill somebody, you could kill five people. If you just went and slaughtered them, that was not considered a capital offense for which you could be executed. You had to have committed another crime at the same time, generally robbery. If there was robbery at the same time, then you could be sentenced to death. Well, what were they going to do? They didn't have capital murder. Well, Tiger Nose had asked Michael Donald to take out his wallet when in the backseat of the Buick as they're driving him out to his death. And the wallet just sat there with a dollar bill in it. It was found a few days later in a dumpster in Mobile without the dollar. They said that was robbery. Well, it had nothing to do with Henry Hayes was on trial. It only had to do with his partner in the thing. And was it robbery? I don't think so. I mean that somebody could have just found. There was no real strong evidence it was robbery, but they wanted to find the murder verdict. But even then, the jury initially, sentenced him to life imprisonment. Now in Alabama, then a couple months later, the judge then that oversaw the case then looks over this verdict and confirms it. He changed the verdict to death, which was very, very rare, almost unheard of at that time. But that's how much at that time the state wanted to execute somebody and show that they weren't racist.
In your book, you have an amazing tale of this Benny Hayes, who is the biggest official in the southern part of Alabama at this Claverne 900. Big influence. He's a big man in town because he owns some properties and he has the cabin where the Claverne meets, where the clan meets. But he has his 5-foot-high youngest son who he thinks is a loser. Tell us about that relationship and the relationship with Benny and Henry, and despite that, Henry still does not rat out his father.
Yeah, well, Benny is just one of those miserable, evil human beings you could ever imagine, okay? Everybody said that he beat his wife, he tried to have sex with his daughter-in-law. One day, he has this dog called White Hope. And the dog tries to kind of get under the fence and get out. So he takes and just cuts all the paws, the ends of the paws, off the dog. And his son is watching this. And his son just starts to cry. He's so appalled at this disgusting, terrible thing his father had done to this beloved dog. And his father just thinks his son is a wimp. He's just a wimp. And so one of the reasons Henry Hayes goes out and kills a black man is to prove to his father that he's a real man. He thinks finally his father will care for him if he kills a black man.
And meanwhile, he is secretly, and it's interesting, you say that his wife overhears that basically it's a reasonable sacrifice, his son, for the Klan.
Yeah, no, afterwards... here Henry's done this to get his father's love and honor, and he thinks now that he's killed his father will respect and watch out for him. But his father says, well, that's okay. If his son has to be executed, somebody has to pay the price, and best it's the son. I mean, just the father doesn't really care. You know, it's terrible for the boy. And Henry, on death row, imagine what it's like, he's on death row. Most of the prisoners on death row in Alabama are black. And there's this racist Klansman going into a cell in this on death row. It was just terrifying. And in the first few weeks, he had people protect him right and left. But after a while, you know, he realizes these black prisoners are his brothers, and he becomes friendly with them. He becomes really friendly with them, and they really protect him. And the night before he dies, who does he talk to but a black preacher? He talks to a black preacher, and for the first time, he confesses that he was indeed one of the two killers of Michael Donald.
Now, Morris Dees, we didn't talk about the actual meeting with Mrs. Donald, and she is a very, very interesting character, and she never attended the trial, but her family did. So tell us about that meeting and what she had said to Morris and what he had said to her to get her confidence that, that he was the right person to handle this and that she could would bother to be, you know, she's pretty cynical about white people in general and especially the law, you said. So what convinced her?
Well, she didn't look, a black woman of that generation. You know, it's hard to talk about this because I don't know who's listening to this. And I know what I was like when I went down there to research this book. I mean, I thought I knew about the South. I thought I knew about slavery and the repression. But I didn't know anything, okay? I didn't know how bad it really was, worse than I possibly imagined. And then for a black woman of Mrs. Donald's generation, I mean, people would just disappear. A black person would just disappear. You didn't go to the police for that. That person was gone. Those are the kinds of things that happen, not only lynchings, but just disappearances. So all she wanted for her son was some measure of justice. She wanted the people that did this to be found responsible. And she, you know what? She wanted somebody to remember her son. She wanted people to remember her son. And Morris came to her, and she learned not to trust people. She definitely learned that. And Morris has a way with people, and you know, and he can talk, and he talked to her and he said, you know, we're going to do this for him, Mrs. Donald. We're going to do this for your son, and she agreed, and when she went along with it. She didn't sit during the murder trial because she was afraid that terrible things would be said about her son, because they said that when they tried to pin the thing on call her son a drug dealer. It was just ridiculous. She's afraid what Henry Hayes might say to kind of blame her son. He didn't do that, but she wasn't in the courtroom for that.
Now, what is his strategy? You say we talked about his other lawyers saying that it was impossible to do, to get this link. It had never been done before. It was unprecedented. If he failed, it would be disastrous. So what was one of the breakthroughs that he had? What was the thing that he did that helped move this ahead in terms of getting a conviction like this, an unprecedented conviction?
Okay, first of all, he had to show a pattern. Okay, one horrendous act of violence, one terrible act isn't enough. He had to show a pattern. I mean, he had the one of what was done to Michael Donald, and he knew that he believed that Robert Sheldon had put forth the racist philosophy that had motivated these people to do that. But that wasn't enough. He was suing for $10 million against the Klansmen, and that wasn't going to do it. But so he had to find a pattern. So he tracked down James Thomas Rowe, who had been an FBI informant, who actually, as an informant, had led a lot of the Klan's most violent actions. I mean, he said I had to do it, but I think it took a little bit too much more pleasure in it. He was in the car on the night at the time of the Selma, after the Selma march, when Viola Luosa, a civil rights an activist from Detroit, was in her car with a young black man. They were driving people back and forth from the airport. And Selma, these four Klansmen were in the car, and they saw this car with the middle-aged white woman, the young black man, and they were going to get this car, and they chased them out into the countryside, going very fast, and it pulled up beside the car, and fired bullets into the car, and killed Viola Luosa. They killed her, okay? And a lot of people think that Roe was one of the people firing those bullets, but because he was an FBI informant, he got off. But he could testify that before they did that, Robert Sheldon had said to them, go out and do what you must do. Now, Robert Sheldon was a smart guy. And the reason he never had any criminal convictions was he was very careful what he said. Go out and do what you can do. He didn't say go and murder somebody. But that's all he had to say was go out and do what you do, and that was enough. And that was what Roe testified to. Roe's deposition was used in the courtroom. He found these people found another Klansman, a Klans leader, another small town in Alabama, whose Claiborne had firebombed a black civil rights leader. They'd fired bullets into the home of a white woman who was dating a black man. when the police chief was worried that the civil rights leader had gone to the FBI. They broke into the civil rights leader's house and stole his papers. And he had been motivated by Robert Sheldon coming and talking to his Clavering and bragging about the violence against people like the Freedom Riders. When the Freedom Riders came in Birmingham, Robert Sheldon wasn't going to get out there and start beating up these guys himself. He was the leader, and he was in his Cadillac, sort of riding this around the streets right near there, watching what was going on. But he was the leader, and so he had motivated these people. That's what they should do. So with this, Deese had the pattern that he needed in that courtroom.
It's interesting. You talked about the deal that he had with these troopers in 21 cars, and they had an agreement: do what you want to these protesters for 15 minutes.
Go ahead. Yeah, it's incredible in Birmingham. I mean, look, in Mobile, the Klansmen did what they called missionary activities. The favorite missionary activity was to go out and beat up a black person. And once you beat them up, and I don't mean just a few, you know, hitting them a few times. I mean brutally beating up somebody. And they're just lying cringing on the ground. And before they left, and the last thing they said to him is, you know, you don't say anything to anybody. You go to the police, and the police are Klansmen, and we will we'll kill you. We'll kill you because we'll hear what you did. So there was a great fear of the police and the Klan, and many of the police in those days were Klansmen. So when the Freedom Riders came to Birmingham, the Klansmen were told by the police, by the top police officials, you got 15 minutes to do whatever you want to these people.
In this time period that you cover in this book, you talk about George Wallace being shot. We don't have enough time to go into everything, but George Wallace being shot by somebody who just wanted to get famous. Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, Martin Luther King assassinated. And the tide towards the kind of sentiment that Robert Sheldon believed that segregation was going to be forever, he started being investigated, and now he's in court with as the Grand Wizard or Grand Dragon being implicated in this. So society had, at least on the surface, had changed its attitude dramatically in a few short years to the surprise and dismay of Robert Sheldon and some of his supporters.
Yes, and that jury that heard the trial in 1987, it was an all-white jury. It was an all-white jury because the Klan lawyer made sure there were no blacks on there. But it was an all-white jury that heard that, and the end came down with a $7 million verdict. So the South was
what
changed.
Was the...
And that's one thing that troubles me today, is you have a lot of young intellectuals, probably more black than white, but anyway, who suggest that things haven't gotten any better. Well, it's a long road, and we're only partway there, but things have gotten a lot better. If you go back to what the South was, how can you deny the struggles that so many people made to get us where we are today?
Now, Morris Deese gained a lot of great attention and adulation from this decision where he brought down the Klan. Tell us about what Morris Deese's mother had said and the family had said and the result of this in terms of recognition, which is really what Mrs. Donald really wanted. What about that recognition for her son?
Well, Mrs. Donald got that. I mean, this is what she wanted. She didn't care about money. She said, I don't want money. I just want justice for my son. And across from the Southern Poverty Law Center building in Montgomery, the Southern Poverty Law Center has built this marvelous civil rights museum. And this panoramic panorama of the history of the civil rights movement. And if you think you know everything, believe all that happened, all the violence, all the troubles, all the struggles. And Michael Donald's picture is right there at the beginning to be remembered for forever. That he's a part of this, just as Martin Luther King was, or Muhammad Ali, or Edgar Evans, whoever.
What was the fate of Robert Shelton?
Robert Shelton became this kind of benign old gentleman who would go to Dunkin' Donuts and have a cream donut and coffee in the morning. And people had no idea that he'd once been the Imperial Wizard of the United Clans of America.
Benny Hayes is portrayed, again, as such a vivid, gruesome character in this. You have him in the trial with his cane and his menacing pointing at witnesses and trying to intimidate people till he has a heart attack during one of the days of the trial. What happens to Benny Hayes?
Well, he's finally going to be brought to justice, yeah, but he's just so old at that point that he dies before he can be brought to trial. But
and
there
what was
the
an fate
attempt.
Of?
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, what was the fate of the others? Well, as I told you, that Henry Hayes was executed. James Tiger
right.
Knowles, he spent 25 years in prison, 20 of them in solitary confinement. He got out. He now, believe it or not, is a kosher chef. He saved his money. He's got about $250,000, and he wants to go back to Alabama and start a restaurant.
Yeah, amazing. And what about the UKA, which was the, again, from the ashes of the Klan came Robert Shelton and an even more menacing version of the Klan in the UKA. What was, you talk about numbers, 50,000 members in America and probably 10 times those sympathizers. What is, because people do watch for that, those kinds of numbers, what is the status now of the Klan? It's not gone.
Well, first of all, this legal theory that Dee's invented has been used a number of times against skinhead groups and white nationalists and crypto Nazis and other Klan groups. So you don't have any more big organizations, okay? You've got small organizations. But troubling things. Just a few days ago in Sacramento, there was a kind of neo-Nazi group that stayed, that was having a protest, and there were knife fights, and 10 people were injured, you know? And there are people out there. It's still a very troubling thing. There's still people with these attitudes, and they pick this stuff off, like Dylan Root did last year in Charleston. They pick it up off the internet. They don't have to become a member of an organization. It's a very troubling time in our society now, and a very dangerous time.
What did Morris Dees go on to? It wasn't the end of his illustrious career, but what else did he go on to do? And his personal life suffered from some of these decisions. But what was a very profound thing is the scene that you have in there where his daughter questions what he's doing and his motivations, and then you write about how he convinces her that it's all worthwhile.
Well, his daughter is in the house. They're putting Christmas ornaments on the Christmas tree. And suddenly these two guys in their camouflage outfits, you know, and their assault rifles coming onto the land to try to kill him. And the security, you know, scares them off. But the daughter, they go in a closet and hide. And the daughter is afraid. And she says to her daddy, why do you have to do this? Why do you do this? And so she brought him down to the trial, the civil trial, with the Michael Donald trial. And she saw for the first time what her daddy was doing. But his life was in risk. Now, he's a very controversial person. Now, some people listening to this will know his name and admire him. Other people just can't stand him, okay? That's the way it is. He's a controversial figure because he stood up for these things. But his life has been in danger. He has security. And again, people don't like him, say he doesn't need security. He's just showing off. He's just wasting money on this. But I know for a fact that as recently as 10 months ago, there was a serious threat. There was a serious threat.
Incredible. Yeah, incredible. You also talk about it took till one of the incidents in there with the young woman, there finally was a conviction of one of the Klan members in 2010. And just to show, again, just a sort of understanding of the time, he only received 6 months.
Right.
Yeah.
But still,
Now, is there some, you talked about the impact that this Morris Dees and the Michael Donald civil suit case had on other organizations like this to be able to bring them to court and dismantle them. What is Morris Dees doing now, other than, again, you say his life is still in danger, but obviously, what is he doing right now?
He's the same guy. He's been married 5 times. He's now living with someone else, and he's been a very, very happy woman he really loves. And he's continuing to do. He still takes his motorcycle trips. I mean, he still works at the Southern Poverty Law Center. He's just a very dynamic person.
What was the effect of writing this book on you? I know that you had said that there were some things that really amazed you that you had no idea of, and of course this is covering a lot of, you know, incredible history in America. What was the overall, I guess maybe the most profound effect for you doing this entire book project?
Well, listen, after World War II, the name Holocaust was not used. It was not until the 50s when Jewish Americans felt it was extremely important to remember this, and this was a way to remember it. And so now we all know that, okay? We all know the Holocaust. We decided that it can't happen again, and what a horror that was. I think we have to know these problems in this era, the civil rights, the struggle for black equality, the evil of slavery that Obama said is the original American sin. We all should know that as Americans, not to feel guilty. I mean, come on, it's not about that anymore. But it's part of our history, and we all should know this and realize what we've come through. It's very important for all of us.
Absolutely. I want to thank you for coming on and talking about the lynching, the epic courtroom battle that brought down the Klan. It's a fascinating book, Lawrence, and I want to thank you for coming on and sharing it with us. For those that might want to follow your work, or do you do Facebook, or you have a website, how people might contact you or find out more about your work?
Yeah, I've got Facebook, and I've got a website, leamer.com. There's not too much on except for my books, but Facebook, too.
Well, thank you very much, Lawrence. A fascinating book. Thank you very much once again for coming on and talking about it. You have yourself a great evening.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Good night.
Good night.